Hi, Mates the Podcast fans. This is your host, Terry Robinson. And our guest today is Monica Speca, one of the characters behind Bonus Experience, the podcast, which is an absolute delight and an amazing insider view on how games are made and how you can improve your game. It's like a much more broad version of this podcast, also good and funny. In addition to that, Monica is a developer for the Onyx Path. Did I get your title correct?
You did.
Thank you so much for joining us. How are you doing today?
Wow, you're welcome. I'm happy to be here. I'm hungry.
Okay, I understand. And not like in the figurative sense, like I'm hungry to talk about Mage.
Yeah, no, I'm waiting for my dinner to be brought to me. I'm literally hungry.
So what does an RPG developer do, especially for the Onyx Path?
Okay, so in layman's terms, it is basically a manager.
Okay.
So you are responsible for hiring your team. You're responsible for crafting the outline for the book. Then you are responsible for wrangling your kittens into order and getting them to do what you asked and to write basically the content that is on the outline to your specifications. Then you receive everybody's first drafts, you review them, you do edits through a process which is called redlines. It's both grammar editing, and then it is also like balance editing. And you referenced this one particular setting element being X in your chapter. Author A and author B referenced the same thing as being Y. I like Y better. Both of you sync up, or whatever. Meet you both halfway or whatnot. So there's like a project management element to it.
Okay.
And then you return those drafts to your writers. You give them more time to do seconds, and then they come back to you. There is often an optional playtest phase, depending on what kind of book you're writing. Some books need more playtesting than others. Obviously, a setting book or a fiction anthology does not need any playtesting.
Yeah. Is this really how Rome was sacked in 1527? Can we get a double check on that? Yeah. Can we give any primary sources?
Right.
Yeah.
And then you are responsible for collecting any feedback from that potential playtest, implementing it, sending. Then if it was kickstarted, then the backers get to, there's like an errata phase. It goes through layout. You read through it. You've catch all the shit you missed. You have to mark down all the page numbers, page number references, and then you send it back. And then there's an errata phase where fans get to go through it and then catch all the stuff that you missed. Then you send that back to be fixed, and then the book goes to print.
Is it still tradition that after the book goes to print, you find that one error that makes you go, fuck?
Yes. No, there is consistently something that you will miss. A typo, a reference that got changed, a page XX that you missed or whatever. So, you know, I mean, it's human effort the whole way down. So when you have humans looking at everything, of course you're going to miss stuff.
For what lines with Onyx Path do you currently serve as a developer?
Scion and Exalted Third Edition.
Oh, fascinating. Yeah. Mage uses a standard D10 system. I think it's now known as the storytelling or storyteller system. What systems do those games or lines use?
So I am a sub-developer for both of them, which means I am not the line developer.
Okay, sorry.
No, it's fine. I'm just telling our audience that I am not the line developer for either of those things, which means I am in charge of individual books. I am not in charge of all of Exalted as much as my friends from the Exalted fandom back in the day really would have liked me to be.
So you're not quite the field commander. You don't have a giant map where you're pushing authors towards it, be like, oh, we need to get this Luna's book out. And then you just suddenly Matt Dawson appears and...
Right. Yeah. Okay. No, nothing quite like that. I am, if they're the field commanders, I am like a squad sergeant or something like that. If this is a miniatures game, I'm like a unique hero unit.
I want to see that in a Twitter bio, like line sub developer, unique hero unit.
So a Scion second edition uses Onyx Path's proprietary original system called Story Path. And I don't know what the Exalted third edition system is called.
We'll call it Exalted third edition for
we'll
now.
We'll call it Exalted third edition for now, because it is no longer Storyteller 2.0, and it is not Story Path. There is a brighter timeline in which Onyx Path acquires the rights to Exalted, and Exalted becomes a Story Path game, but that is not the reality we live in.
As a developer and game enthusiast, when you look at a game, what makes someone say, we want to use this system or we want to use that system?
Well, that is sort of what my whole podcast is about.
Dun, dun, dun. What was that subject matter expert?
Oh, boy. Well, because that's a big fucking question, Terry. Why choose one system over another? All right, let me see if I can sort of distill this down into something that's not an audio essay. So when you're choosing a system, I assume you mean as like a homebrewer, right?
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. So you say, you look at Mage the Ascension, the right. notional game that we're discussing, and you say, this sucks at this, this, and this. I want to use that.
X, Y, and Z to
yes.
A, B, and C. Uh-huh. So basically what you have to do is create design goals. Go listen to BXP episode 2, House Rules the Gateway Drug to Game Design.
Okay.
So basically you have to have like a design principle. Why are you making the choice you want to make? And so I guess sort of the problem in air quotes, because house rules can be bad, but who cares? Because it's just your friends you're inflicting this on. But if you want to sort of think about it on a bigger level, you have to think about why you're making this choice. If you really like, I'm going to just pick on Dungeons and Dragons because this is my favorite thing to do. If you really like classes as a thing, as a discrete mechanical entity, then you probably want to stick with something like D&D that requires that to be there. Otherwise, you sort of stray away from the original thing. If you want to play with something like classic World of Darkness, you probably love the idea of a D10 dice pool, and you probably like the idea of a smaller one, not an exalted size one.
Oh man, I am sometimes envious of the, okay, this, this, and this happens, roll 27 dice. And you're like, and then, like, you just hear this thunderous noise.
Yeah, it's a beautiful sound. I highly recommend to anyone, if you have a horde of D10s, just pick up as many as you can hold in both hands and throw them on your table. And that is what playing Exalted feels like.
Exactly. Add stunts to it and very specific non-Western references to clothing and food.
Right. And if you're going to lift something for Mage from another system, first you need to identify what you dislike about the existing parts of Mage. And if it's my understanding of Awoed is correct, it's basically there's a lot to dislike because it's old. And there's a lot to like, too. And so you don't want to toss the things you like, or you want to smooth out the things you like to work better to your taste.
What are some of the criticisms that you commonly face with Awoed systems?
So do you still play with the ones take away successes?
Yes.
Okay, because that's a problem. What?
I just like the before the call, you're like, I don't actually play any of these games.
No, like, okay, mathematically, it's a problem.
Yes.
Like, literally, mathematically, it's a problem. I don't, like, if you enjoy it, whatever, fine. But mathematically, it is a problem because of the way the bell curve works. The bigger your pool gets, the higher you are to fuck up. Like, it actually gets more likely that you will cancel out of success the bigger your dice pool gets. So that there's an intrinsic problem with that in a White Wolf game because the more you progress, the bigger your dice pool gets.
Oh, yeah.
The more experienced a character is, the less likely they are to succeed.
And sometimes developers will refer to something like, I don't know if this is a term of art that anyone actually used, but ludonarrative dissonance. Like, what is the gap between the game that the mechanics are playing and the game that the setting in the book is playing? And right. that's one of those weird cases where they'll go against each other. That became a huge issue with not necessarily quite successes so much as botches before they introduced the rule of one, which is to say, if you have any successes, it's not a botch. But yeah, that was it started being a problem where, like, oh, your botch percentage increases with your understanding of the world around you.
Yeah, that's one of the things that is just sort of mathematically a problem with the system. So if I were to get a wild hair at my butt and decide to run Mage, which of the old World of Darkness games would be my choice.
Oh, you're so kind.
I'm not blowing smoke up your butt. That is the truth.
You pander so good.
It's not pandering. It is. That is the God's honest truth.
Okay.
My husband has a copy of Sorcerer's Crusade downstairs, and I keep being like, every time I walk past it.
I just like the way you're like, hello there. Like, I like the idea where your husband's like, I saw you talking to the book again.
It was like, it's like that the distracted guy meme.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
The one lady is like, work I should be doing, and then Sorcerer's Crusade is the other lady, and the guy in the middle is me.
Proofreading 172 more Exalted Charms.
Charms, yeah.
Yeah.
Fortunately, I'm developing the Exalted Storyteller's Guide, which is not going to involve 172 new charms. And like, I think part of why you would want to continue playing an old World of Darkness game is because you like sort of the core things that make it interesting, like abilities and attributes and D10s and rolling for successes and target numbers, variable target number, like target number being the number on the die, which I know old World of Darkness calls difficulty.
Mm-hmm.
Variable difficulty, as in changing the target number on the die, can get a little bit sticky, but it isn't the worst thing in the world. The ones taking away as successes is a much bigger math problem than changing target number. That's just really more of a bookkeeping problem. And you probably want like subsplats, so like your Order of Hermes. Yeah, so your mage splat would be like Order of Hermes. And you probably have a set of five, probably some sort of morality track. Willpower optional, in my opinion. If you like it, keep it cool. It's another spendable resource. So I would analyze, think about what you like, what you don't like, and what you think needs to be a breath of fresh air, or what would certainly change the way you play the game for the group you play it with. Because when you're house ruling, what you're really doing is doing basically like micro game design for an audience of like six people.
Makes sense.
Right. You're not writing a chapter for a book that's going to go into publication, that's going to be played by hundreds or thousands of people, that's going to affect the other people's enjoyment of a certain IP. No mm-hmm. pressure. And when you do house rules, basically you're just saying, I'm going to change it if I want to, because I'm going to tailor the way this game works for the way our group likes it. And then you're just, it's like a tiny little design sphere.
Do you feel that that is a process that a storyteller or chronicler should engage in regardless, just to ask players periodically, hey, are there things that you feel are causing our sessions to slow down or things that just don't make sense to you?
Heck yeah.
And how do you differentiate between things that are narrative versus things that are system? Is there a...
That's a hard question. I mean, that comes with experience.
Okay.
And developing that designer's eye. And like, I think that is something you can definitely learn, as obviously you can get a degree in game design, which I don't have, but maybe I should. but some people also just sort of have the knack. I'm one of those people. I'm trying to think of a good example. Like,
so can I give you a thing where a player approached me
sure.
and made mention of the fact that here is one complaint, and this is probably one of the most trivial ones. The player is uncomfortable anytime they're in like a room and they need to find a clue, and invariably wits plus awareness or alertness or streetwise or subterfuge comes into play, and no one gets any successes, and suddenly the plot comes to a grinding halt because of that.
Okay, that is totally a fault of the core system, because as far as I know, Mage doesn't have procedural rules.
What does that mean? Like, what would a procedural rule be?
Procedural is for, like, investigations, solving mysteries, like a police procedural.
Okay. What games have those kind of mechanics?
StoryPath has them. and so does Age, Modern Age. That's the Dragon Age. So Dragon Age had its own setting. Like its own system, the mm-hmm. Dragon Age RPG, and then apparently they made a modern version called Modern Age, and mm-hmm. the Modern Age version has apparently a pretty robust investigation procedural type rule set that was written by Megan Fitzgerald, who is the line developer for...
Changeling the Lost?
Yep, Changeling the Lost. One of my good friends, also an awesome person. Also a tremendous rules guru. The other day she was asking me for rules help, and I was like, Senpai, notice me, holy shit! Yeah, so that the Gumshoe games, like Ashen Stars, Trail of Cthulhu. Shit, there's another one. Fuck, there's another one. I'm drawing a blank. They're all by Pelgrane Press.
I think the previous six examples give a start. So can you kind of outline what a procedural mechanic would kind of look like? Is the investigation broken down into phases or something like that? Is it a question that you always get to the answer, but the amount of time maybe changes?
So I've been working on design stuff for Scion Demigod, and I actually literally have the StoryPath procedural rules page open because I've been referencing it over and over again. So I'm going to talk about StoryPath because it's the one I'm the most familiar with. The other two examples, let me finish the rest of the thought. Is the Gumshoe is specifically an entire game system about playing investigations.
Okay.
So basically, whenever you enter an investigation scene, like if you're researching or you're casing a joint or like you're sniffing around for clues, the story guide, which is the fancy name for the storyteller, because we can't say storyteller anymore, he or she or they straight up tells you where the leads are. That is baked into the system.
Okay.
When you enter the crime scene, you're like, there's blood spatter on the wall. You notice that the books on the bookshelf have been overturned as if someone was rooting through them furiously. There are bloody footprints leading out to the balcony, you know, and it looks like there was a struggle that pulled the curtains down. And then it's up to the players to then investigate the curtains the overturned books, the footprints on the balcony, the blood spatter on the wall. Then there are a bunch of different approaches you can use to find clues. Analysis, cracking, interrogation, surveying, and research. So analysis is like the forensic lab type stuff. Mm-hmm. Research is hitting the books or like looking stuff up online. Surveying would be like casing the scene. Interrogation would be speaking to witnesses. And cracking would be like hacking or whatever, or lying. Cracking is for using like sly methods to get the information, such as hacking or, you know, coercing it out of someone.
Okay.
So it gives you approaches. It says first you give everybody leads and it gives you these approaches for how you want to do it. And then in story path, when you roll, you generate successes, and successes you can spend on what are called stunts, which are basically just like ways you can apply your successes. The things you can do in procedural are extra clue, cost you one success. When you spend that, the GM gives you an extra clue in addition to whatever you found.
Okay.
So if I am using the surveying action to investigate those overturned books on the bookshelf, I make my initial roll. I hit the base difficulty of one. It runs off of Chronicles rules. So the base difficulty for anything, which is the number of successes you require, not the number on the die, one. So I roll my pool. I get two successes. So that's one. I meet the default difficulty. So the GM tells me, you know, you notice that the books appear to be alphabetized. It appears that the victim was really into the occult. And you notice that, judging from alphabetical order, the tome based that they had for learning to summon, you know, the Jotun from Norse mythology is missing. So that's my clue from just passing the success. But I'm like, okay, well, I hit one for extra clue. And then GM then might also tell me that there are bloody fingerprints on the other tomes or whatever.
Okay.
And so then I have two clues and I can go from there.
So is it safe to say that story path is about a game where you spend successes?
Yes, it is exactly that.
And I guess it's one of those things where if you're looking for a mechanic, like one of the standard ones is picking the lock on a door that is alarmed. In Old World of Darkness, that could be broken up into two things or it raises the difficulty, but there isn't a good way to represent, yeah, you got the door open, but the alarm went off. Or alternatively, you disabled the alarm, but you weren't able to get the door open. So it sounds like in this system, you would say, to get everything done, it's going to take four successes. You can blow two successes to cancel out either one of those complications.
Right. In fact, there is a default mechanic called complications, which are additional successes you have to spend on things. And if you don't buy them off, they don't prevent you from succeeding. But if you don't buy them off, they make shit happen.
Hmm.
So you could say picking the lock on this armed door is difficulty one. It's not that hard. But there's a two complication of electronic lock. And if you don't buy it off, the alarm will go off, or at least silently alert the security guards, and then you'll have to deal with the fact that they're coming for you. So you get in the room, you progress the story. It's sort of a weird backwards baked in partial success mechanic.
Okay.
So like one of the things I used to do when I ran a lot of Exalted, because Exalted is is an older game, editions previous to third edition, when people miss the difficulty by one, I treated it like a partial success.
So in that case, that was a game where difficulty was defined by the number of successes you need, or the number of on the die. Okay.
First one, Exalted doesn't mess around with changing what I'm going to continue to call the target number.
It seems like that it is the case that games have fallen into two categories: either ones that change the number of successes, or one that changed the difficulty, but not both.
Right.
So it seems kind of, and is that just a courtesy to the player then, to make it so that there's only one knob that ever gets to change? Or is there, as a game designer, is there something else fundamental to that worldview that changes things?
Honestly, I think it's a general trend towards less bookkeeping.
Okay. You had also made mention, you referred to willpower as, I think, a spendable resource. And there seem to be games where you have multiple of those. What is the mechanical benefit of giving your player kind of arbitrary access to this other resource to smooth things along or to have depleted?
Right. So if you're going to make a game that includes a fair amount of resource management, you really have to consider why you have multiple resources. From where I'm sitting right now, I literally cannot tell you a good reason for why some things include one type of resource and not the other. Or rather, like why you have quintessence and willpower. At least I'm going to continue to make comparisons to Scion, because I've done a ton of work on it. Scion and all story path games have a resource called momentum, which is a group resource and is generated when you fail stuff, when the GM can offer it to you in return for doing something. I can bribe you with it.
Can you give an example of that bribery?
Sure. basically, like, let's say you're playing this like really hot-headed Irish scion, and you want to you're in a bar and you some this like satyr is causing some is talking shit on you, and the GM might be like, hey, you want to start a fight? Here's a momentum.
Okay. So yeah. It is, I think the figure of speech you have previously used, like, so no one likes being railroaded, but I feel like far too many things are called being railroaded for the audience is a scenario where the storyteller kind of forces the flow of action along a very specific predetermined route, and player autonomy doesn't really factor in too much. There's a level below that, which I believe Bonus Experience refers to as offering a bus ticket.
Yes.
all aboard the plot bus. My players refer to that as me being a Cleopatra. like when that came out, I'm like, oh, is this the game we're playing? Mage the wig snatching? I understand. But any case where you don't necessarily have to go this way, but where you suggest as a storyteller, hey, if you do that, Someone spent is their precious spare time coming up with a story centered around that. How about that? This is kind of a way of making that quid pro quo very explicit.
Yes. And it's usually to bribe the character into something they'd probably consider doing anyway. In Fate, this is called a compel. But in Fate, you also mechanically define parts of your character. They're called aspects. And you have something called a trouble, which is specifically a mechanically reinforced part of your character that will get you in the shit.
Would this be like a vice or the downside of the nature and demeanor in Old World of Darkness? Is it kind of in that vein, just the thing your character...
It's like that, except you get to make it up.
That sounds mechanically fascinating and super useful. And I like the idea that we have found a way to systematize certain things and give an actual tangible representation of that. So, So I accumulate a momentum die. How do I use the die?
You can use it to basically as a die adder.
Okay.
It goes into a community pool of momentum. The whole community, all four, five, whatever players have access to it. So you have certain things. The knacks are powered by momentum, but knacks are also often free.
What is a knack?
It is an ability tied to your archetypal calling as a demigod, as opposed to a boon, which is your literal divine magic. So a knack is more like a superhero ability as opposed to a godly one. Warrior knacks make you fight better as opposed to war boons, which give you supernatural ability over command, you know?
Okay.
When you have a war boon, that makes, you know, your soldiers fight fearlessly. And when you have a warrior knack, that makes you really great at, you know, beating the shit out of someone.
Warsmanship.
Okay. Warmanship, yeah.
Yeah.
It's more about the actual, like, combat system fighting part as opposed to the leadership or, you know,
as opposed to Rob Roying that shit. Got
right,
it.
Correct.
We'll take our lives, but they'll never take our momentum dice pool.
Yes. Okay. Yes. So by design, those two types of powers pull from two different pools so that you're not starved for power in either case.
Does this also give the player a opportunity to be like, hey, this gas tank is kind of low. What can I do to fill it up again? Okay. Because the willpower mechanic in where before they introduce the, you can get willpower back from completing a story, getting emotional closure, being who you are fundamentally as a person at the apex of your game, or getting a good night's sleep. That last one kind of.
Or going to bed.
Exactly. You went to bed at a reasonable hour and you didn't drink. Here's a willpower point. So that is something where you can request from the storyteller, hey, what's a scenario where I can kind of get this up? I don't want to be running on empty there. So you may mention that it is a shared pool. So we have everyone at the table. And is there a mechanic to prevent, like, Jimmy McGrabby dice from stealing all the momentum dice? Or is that just a political thing that you need to be able to work out with your players?
Really sort of a, like, hey, don't be an asshole. Play in good faith. Like, one of the troubles of playing sort of a less, what I guess folks call a traditional game, which would be like an Old World of Darkness, a D&D, that type, versus a more story-driven game. And I literally mean like a story game. Let me see, like, I think of a really good example. StarCrossed.
Okay. Sorry. These will all go in the show notes.
Magnificent game where you and one other person collaboratively tell a story of your two characters falling in love.
Okay.
It's all about romantic tension, and you play with a Jenga tower, and as you consistently, like, flirt and develop your relationship, you pull blocks out of the Jenga tower, and when the Jenga tower falls down, the tension breaks, you guys fall in love, okay. You either, like, go off to go fade to black or whatever, but then the game is over. So it is almost purely a game about that story.
Oh, interesting. So at one hand, you just kind of want to knock over the Jenga tower, but it very quickly proves you, like, congratulations, you won a romance game. But so, like, implicitly, you kind of want this Jenga tower to be awkward and precarious and maybe get a boner in public or something, just like in
the whole thing is, the point of that is to tell that tension building story.
Okay.
Like, that is the goal of the game. Yeah. So, like, if you want to separate between the two, the one being still sort of rooted in the these types of games grew up out of D&D, which grew up out of war games, and so they still sort of have a little bit of that war game DNA, as opposed to the games that do not. That is pretty much how I would split that.
Are there any mechanics kind of in the Momentum Dice world that would be under consideration that can kind of be plugged in? Sometimes I hear one of the ones that I hear about in Exalted are stunts.
Oh, well, quite frankly, you can mine story path and take a lot of the ideas back into Old World of Darkness with you without it really breaking anything. So stunting in Exalted is literally describe your action in a cool manner and we'll give you some dice.
So again, that is another mechanic where you are encouraging behaviors that the designers feel will improve the quality of the game. So there is nothing to preventing someone in OWAD from being very flowery in their speech. But here's an actual gosh darn die.
I'm misrepresenting that. It's not just here's a gosh darn die, because your dice pool's already pretty goddamn big.
Okay.
It is also a way to restore motes, which is the Exalted spendable resource, and willpower, Exalted's other spendable resource. So not only can a cool stunt get you more dice and push you closer to success, but a cool stunt might also get you back the cost of your charm.
In Exalted and Scion, there is an idea that your character is poised for greatness, that you are one of the chosen or something like that. Do you feel that breaks the idea of a system, for instance, in Old World of Darkness, where you're just another mage or you're just another vampire? Do you feel like there's a way of justifying it, even if it doesn't have this idea of fate or greatness baked into it?
That's a tone thing. But like, so if you want to introduce, stunts into mage and it gives you quintessence back, cool. Maybe you just put on the parameters that only happens when you're describing spells. Maybe you say you can always describe your spell, your rote, or your improvised spell casting in a cool manner. Exalted First Edition and Second Edition, and then even sort of rolling into Third Edition, had sort of tiered stunts, and I think that is a very dumb idea. I mean, I loved it when I was younger, but I don't anymore. Where like a one die stunt was, well, you tried, and a two die stunt was either you tried harder or you included some scenery. And a three-die stunt was you blew everyone away. The description of how to award that in Exalted First Edition said you made everyone at the table say, damn, that was cool.
Hey, it's in a rule book. It's official.
It is in a rule book. It's official. And our college group made them vanishingly rare, such to the point that we had a three-die stunt club.
Okay.
Of which I was the leading member.
Aw. Foreshadowing.
So I don't really think you should tier the goodness of someone's stunts, because some people are better at off-the-fly descriptions than another. You should reward the effort.
Someone tried to paint a good mind picture. That should get something.
Yes, that should get something. Like, and especially if that... and by the way, the reward in motes and willpower you got back was dependent on how good your stunt was.
Okay.
So you see a bit of the problem here?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, like, if you're going to tie something really important, like quintessence, to stunting, which, listen, I am 100% here for playing mage with stunning spells, then, you know, give everybody the same reward. If you make an effort to describe your spell above, I cast
fireball. Magic missile. Yeah.
I cast magic missile. Yeah. If you
attack the darkness.
Bigger and better than I hit him with my sword, the mage equivalent of I hit him with my sword, then it is a stunt and it awards two dice and or a point, your choice of quintessence or willpower or whatever.
Do you feel that the rest of the game then needs to change to take this into consideration? Like, when I was reading through stunts, the neatest thing that it adds to me is it allows me as a storyteller to more or less present a impossible scenario that a character can stunt out of.
Mm-hmm. There's that too.
Okay.
I mean, when you throw in that new narrative permission, like, oh, here are these impossible situations where you can now describe your way out of. Or like, normally you couldn't use this sphere to do this thing. Or does Old Mage have the whole, like, if you're from these two spheres, you have an opposite one that your mage type just doesn't get? Okay.
Not really. No
mage Pokemon. Okay.
No. Oh, you're a grass type mage, so you do worse against psychic. Yeah.
Well, that's one of the things I actually kind of enjoyed about Chronicles Mage, is that, like, if you are this one type of mage, you have these two favored magic
arcana
types, and then the opposite arcana is foreign and alien to you, which is neat. from a setting perspective.
Which is also a mechanic you can totally grab for mage. It would make sense that if you're looking at the each tradition is going to have a thing that is particularly alien to them.
Right, alien to them. It's a cool concept if you wanted to throw that into your game, that's neat. And so if you were rolling with something like that as a setting aspect, perhaps you could say, well, you can stunt to have that understanding or whatever. To try to break the rule around that. But then that's literally a tone thing. And it's not going to break the game mechanically unless you, as the storyteller, are particularly concerned with how quickly Quintessence comes back. Personally, I think if you're going to play a mage game, I'm here to cast spells and do magic. I'm a mage. I want to do magic. Like, let me do this without paradoxing myself into oblivion, please and thank you. If that's the tone you want to go for, then by all means reinforce it with stunts. And that introducing, adding narrative permissions to do something big like that is what makes your game feel epic and makes the characters feel like powerful agents of magic.
Wizardologists. Witchalocks.
I almost said archmages, but that's a thing.
that's one of those special reserve words.
That is a thing.
It's like trying to register your username as admin. It sounds like you're outlining a process that is to say, have a discussion with your players and say, what do you feel is working? What about what we're doing do you like? What are the speed bumps on the way to that? And then you propose a mechanic and you either give it a try or you think through and say, will this still fit with the tone? Right. And if the answer is yes, great, give it a roll. If the answer is no, it sounds like that's not like a hard stop. That's a, am I comfortable with the new tone this creates? Because to me, the question of are mages super mages always came back to how you deal with the experience system. Like if you take the experience as written, where at the end of your session, you can get 2 or 3 points of experience and you play every Friday and your mage session represents roughly 1 week of in-game time or something like that. At the end of the year, one of your characters can go from fresh out of the box mage to a master, where in the fiction of the game, that is generally represented as being a 5 to 10 year process.
Right.
So you can either say, my mages are special, and if they are special, then stunt the living bejesus out of them because my mages are special. Or you also have other things that you need to, I guess, take care of. Have there been any advancements in like what I'll just call game design that you feel that a 25-year-old system just kind of should have? Like Blades in the Dark is a game that Bonus Experience seems quite fond of.
Mm-hmm.
And I got it. And one, I was angry because it was so small. And I'm like, damn it. Stupid, concise writing. But that game is fantastically tight in terms of everything feeds into everything else. To me, it is almost a board game with role playing.
Interesting. The design space that a lot of the stuff that Blades has is from that more story game tradition?
Pardon me. To me, it is a board game in the sense that I don't have a better mind space to explain it, in the sense that every resource is tracked and everything feeds into everything else. And every application of one resource, it very implicitly means that you're not doing this other thing. So for the audience, one of the things that Blades in the Dark does super well is it divides the game into kind of two phases. One, the quest or the story, which they refer to as the score, and then downtime. And the way the game builds it, in Mage, downtime can be a day, it can be a week, it can be a month, it can be a year. Your character can be researching someone, they can be grieving a dead relative, they can be out at a dojo training. But in Blades in the Dark, it's very specifically, you get two of these actions, pick two.
Yep. I mean, the amount of time that can pass when you take those two actions and between the next score can be any amount of time.
Yes.
But you get to do two things during downtime, and those two things can take as much or as little time as needs be. Because I'm actively playing in a Blades game right now.
I will soon be actively playing in a Blades game. Hopefully that is not the RPG equivalent of someone saying first annual. Like there's a little too much hope built into that. But one of the neat things, for instance, Blade does is if you try and do two, you can request additional downtime actions, but the game reflects that as saying, okay, you're laying low for a while. You're going to start losing reputation. People are going to see that you are not active and your gang or group is no longer going to have the positive regard of the other criminal elements. So it seems like an exquisite set of trade-offs that is beautifully balanced.
Blades is really tightly designed to be kind of about the hard give and take. And like Blades characters, in many instances in the BXP back catalog, I have talked about Ash, my cutter, which is the fighty class in Blades.
Which is an interesting case of a game that doesn't actually have classes. It just has specializations or emphases.
They're called playbooks. Yeah. And playbooks are basically just a big fancy name for class, but it's really more like character archetype. You could also make it analogous to like a White Wolf splat.
Okay.
They're much tighter than that, but that's getting a little inside baseball. We're here to talk about
Outside baseball. Mage ball.
But so really your characters aren't heroic. Like they're not larger than life heroic figures. The dice kind of tell you that too. They have to make hard choices about their stress. They have to make hard choices about their money. And like you said, it's really tightly designed. The resource management in that game is excellent. See, back to the point of why do you need two spendable resources? Is the resource management in this game good? And how that informs tone, because you don't really want to get injured. Getting injured fucking sucks. And one of the things you can do is instead take stress, but stress is also your resource for sometimes fueling your moves and for pushing yourself to get extra dice or for helping people. Yet you have to make so many hard choices, and it's just immaculately well put together, which is why it's one of our favorite games.
Would it be accurate to say that it is balanced? I'm hard-pressed to come up with a better term besides tight, which always feels uncomfortable in the same way that I don't like saying the word moist. No, I'm fine with the word moist. I do not like saying the word juicy. That's the one that was always uncomfortable for me. I was the weirdo. But it seems like stress as a mechanic is kind of like willpower, but the difference is it is ex post facto willpower. It is willpower you can blow after a bad thing happens to say how your character is doing something to deal with the consequences of it and to minimize that effect. Is it a reasonable mechanical change in Old World of Darkness to just introduce a rule that says, hey, we're going to slightly change the way willpower works and we're going to make it closer to stress. You can blow it after the fact, but the amount you need to blow to get your guaranteed one success or to salvage something is now suddenly going to be variable. Oh, also, if you ever deplete all of your willpower, your character is more or less going to get a flaw.
That sounds really cool to me, actually.
Yeah,
that sounds great. The thing to consider with that is then if other things cost willpower, like spells or rotes or whatever.
Willpower is almost never a mandatory cost to do a thing.
Okay, because in Exalted, charms cost motes and willpower. And I think sometimes vampire disciplines can also cost blood and willpower. But yeah, so as long as that's not going to put another strain on using the thing you're supposed to use, which is your spells, then cool, fine, perfect, that's fantastic. If you're putting into something where willpower can also be a cost for your powers, then you have to sort of consider how you're putting a strain on those and the domino effect that would happen.
But one of the things you mentioned is the fact that it is fine having a resource, but it is problematic if everything in the game kind of points back to that resource.
Mm-hmm. Unless you're doing like a stress from Blades where the hard choice between those things is the point.
Okay. What else has improved in games over the past 25 years?
Boy, lots of things have improved in the last 25 years. Story games have become sort of a thing. And then the idea of like basically like giving incentives to doing things that are purely narrative, things that like I described aspects in Fate to you earlier. Fate aspects are player defined. They are purely narrative, but they have a mechanical knock on. So like we're actually playing a Kung Fu Pirates Fate game right now. And you have what's called a high concept, which is like you're defining who you are as a character. And my character for that game's high concept is Land Raider turned Sea Raider.
Okay.
So I'm playing this like former road highwayman road bandit who is now on a boat but has taken their horse with them.
Okay.
I've been doing all these ridiculous like martial arts stunts from the back of a horse on a boat with my merry band of brigands with me who are not pirates at all. And
Okay. My
trouble is all that glitters is mine. Yeah. So you can see how that is both like potentially positive, but also very much a thing that a GM could be like, hey, you want to steal this thing? And then when, like, let's say my character, whose name is Wandering Horizon, is, you know, losing a fight, but is doing it on horseback on a boat, as I've been doing. And one of the things you can do is spend one of your resources called Fate Points to invoke an aspect. And I'm like, well, I should be kicking his ass because, you know, I'm fighting on a horse or boat, and that's my thing. So I'm going to invoke...
Oddly, this is kind of my deal rule.
Right, it's my whole thing. So I'm going to invoke Land Raider turn Sea Raider and add +2 to this roll result and bump that up to defeating this guy, to succeeding as opposed to failing. And so, like, that idea of a narrative thing, like, that... Of course, it's my thing. I should be doing it. I should be winning here. And then having the mechanical knock-on of, okay, it's cost me one of my in-game resources to make that happen. So like that kind of idea has really permeated game design in the last decade. And you even see it in freaking D&D 5th edition.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Dungeon world, like, there's also a lot of move towards establishing and mechanizing and reinforcing the relationship between player characters. Apocalypse World has a thing called history, where you sort of define your relationship to another character and, like, what you did in the past together, and that can either be good or bad, and you can use your history to aid or interfere with people. You know what Blaze in the Dark playbooks look like?
Yes.
They're a cousin of Apocalypse World playbooks. Okay. So you know how on one of my favorite things from Blaze in the Dark playbooks is your allies and enemies, your dangerous friends or whatever, and you just get to pick which two of these characters who are just a name and a brief description and their relationship to you, like that kind of stuff. That's all been things that have been introduced. But your history is defined by your playbook. You don't get to make up, bruh. We had a no homo moment lifting weights or whatever. that was definitely not a no homo moment. But you may have been like, hey, you, I pointed at you like your character. Hey, you, Terry playing, you know, Socket Wrench. You stole from me. Fuck you. That's your history with me. And I determined that. And then like, then we roll from there because that's what was on my playbook. So-and-so stole from you. Fuck them. And then it gives you a history rating. And then that affects your die rolls for when, let's say I'm mad at you and I want to interfere with you in character. I probably wouldn't be mad at you out of character. You know, my character, Sawblade, is really mad at your character, Socket Wrench. And she wants to interfere with your attempt to like repair our post-apocalyptic compounds only Jeep because I'm a jerk. And, and so like I make my aider interfere role invoking our history because I hate you because you stole from me. And that affects the result of my role.
So a lot of them seem to be things that create an interplay between narrative and mechanics. Yeah. And it prevents and it gives you an inducement to kind of do what your character probably wants. One of the things that always bothered me about Old World of Darkness is it doesn't do a good job of giving systems for motivations, mm-hmm. with the exception of Wraith, where you have passions, where you regain a resource by indulging in a thing. Do any newer games have a list of, oh, this is what your character wants. If someone is playing to this, it's going to be easier for them. If you are trying to do something to further this, you're going to have an enhanced dice pool because it super fits in with your morals and your worldview. That to me was something that Old World of Darkness didn't really have. Are there any newer games that have that? My immediate thought is Intimacies from Exalted.
Yeah, Intimacies from Exalted Second Edition were not great. Like, they tried to do that, but they didn't do it very well. And I'm saying Exalted Second Edition specifically because I think they're a little bit better implemented in third, but I can't think of it off the top of my head. Scion Second Edition has, your pantheon has virtues, so where you act in accordance with, like, I think the Norse one is fatality versus audacity, and when you act in accordance with those, like, two guiding principles, you shift your virtue track, and once you're all the way over, you become virtuous, and when you can invoke your virtue, and then you get extra dice for being either extremely fatalistic as a Norse demigod or extremely audacious. So either like black metal, nothing matters, everything
darkness.
Is death,
darkness. No parents.
Brutal.
Yeah.
Or like drink a river, fight a giant, fuck his mom, Thor style. Thor style audacity.
There has to be a dance with that, like cut to the side and you've got like the Yggdrasil backup dancers or something.
Right.
The fly maidens.
You get extra dice for becoming virtuous and that there's sort of that. But you also get to define paths, which are very much like aspects and fate in that they are player defined things that both shape the way your character is literally created, and also you can invoke them to do stuff like, because I am the right hand of Thor, I therefore get to call upon the Valkyries or whatever. You also get to define what are called deeds, which are basically just like things you want to do. They are short term and long term. When you resolve deeds, that pushes you towards increasing your legend, which is the big power stat.
Yeah. And you make mention of big power stat. Are there so you had D&D first edition where it was score the loot. You had D&D second edition where it's kill the thing. In Mage and Old World of Darkness, it's do the plot. And in a lot of newer games, it seems to be deal with shit, like that character development is a proxy for, so your character overcomes a roadblock or learns a thing about themselves, or we discover that the true enemy all along was friendship or something like that. I don't know.
the true enemy.
Exactly. Well, one of the recurring themes in Old World of Darkness is the only people that can cooperate are the bad guys. Like the Nefandi can more or less have a potluck, despite the fact that they're like serving Yog-Sothoth. And you know that they're super bad because they get along with all the other bad people in the same way that you read a Superman comic and you've got like the Legion of Doom that has like a schedule on whose day it is to empty the dishwasher, but the Justice League can barely hold their shit together. Like the ability to work with other people is a sign of darkness. And then I have seen things in Chronicles of Darkness about things like beats and breakpoints and so on. Has the science of experience or leveling up, as it were, changed much over time?
Yes and no. A lot of systems still use experience in the way that you'd understand it being an old World of Darkness fan, in that like you earn it for doing stuff in game, for like showing up, mm-hmm. for completing the session, and then you spend it in variable ways on things on your character sheet. So like that concept is still around. And frankly, there's nothing wrong with that concept. And in fact, D&D 5th edition still uses levels pretty much like every other D&D ever has. Unlike Basic Expert First and Second, not Second, Basic Expert and First, it's not based on the gold you bring back. It's just based on, I think it's encounters completed. Honestly, when we were playing a bunch of D&D regularly, we just made it story-based. You just leveled up at the end of a story arc. And frankly, completely narrative advancement is my preference at this point in time. But you also have like Blades in the Dark, where when you roll a desperate action, you get to mark an experience. You can train to increase experience. At the end of every session, you go around and you talk about what you did during that. And then there's a bunch of like checkboxes on your character sheet that tell you how you gain experience. The Cutter gets theirs for solving a problem with violence or coercion. And then beliefs, heritage, or drives is one of them. And then you get to mark them each one potentially twice, meaning you can earn up to 6 XP a session, not including training. I almost always hit my first one twice.
Okay.
So, and part of that is then you also have to be willing to give yourself credit for that. But I also like the way that Blades does it. And then Blades basically has a track. Once that track fills up, you mark it off, and then you get to increase the dots like you would in any White Wolf game. To actually answer the goddamn question, I think we, like, yes, some things have stayed the same, but yes, also things have changed.
Okay, so it seems like there are more options, as it were, where as a storyteller, you can say, do I want to make sure the characters are in a certain place so we can run a certain story, versus do I really want to encourage characters to build muscles, as it were, to do the thing, and if they do the thing good, they do the thing gooder next time, or stick with whatever came in the darn book, and all of those are entirely appropriate. Do you ever run what I'll call phase games, where you have a story arc with characters just at each kind of level of skill, where you have... We have a story, no one's awakened. We have a story, everyone's just awakened. We have a story, everyone's a journeyman magician, everyone's like an adept. We do a story, everyone's a master. We do a story, we kill everyone because Archmage games are no fun. Is that is there a term for that or stories of that style? I see that occasionally floating around, or is that just a thing that happens?
I think it's just a thing you can do.
Okay.
Have I done that myself? No. Typically, not in sequential order like that. I would run a game where I'm like, okay, I have this really cool idea, but it is specifically for mages who have just awakened because I want to tell a specific story about people who are dealing with the cosmic power they can now control, because I think that's compelling. And I'm going to try to bus ticket everybody in onto this premise, you know? Woo. And then I might have another game where I'm like, well, I actually have a cool idea for what an Archmage game might be like. And so like, I might run an Archmage game with people who I think would buy into that because I have a cool idea for how I think that's going to go. So I certainly have started plenty of other games at a certain power level or a certain experience level or with a certain number of points or whatnot because I have an idea that involves being at that level.
Are you using the same characters and moving them forward and backward, or is it one of those things where it's like, okay, new character sheets, we want to do this story?
Usually, unless it's, like I said, I haven't ever done them in sequence.
Okay.
So if I have an idea for brand new Exalt characters, I'll just pick on Exalted. If I have an idea for brand new Exalts, I will run a game about being brand new Exalts, and then that probably will last until that novelty wears off or until the story itself mutates because the players took it from me. Which, makes whenever sense. You run Exalted, will it inevitably happen. And then I might have a cool concept for playing Elder Exalts, like really powerful Exalts, and then I might have to house rule how that goes, or because high essence charms were not really a thing, and you had to write those all yourself. So, like, I might have an idea for what a really powerful Exalted game is like, and then I might give out an X number of XP. I may totally be talking about having already done something like that. And, you know, that would be a different game. That would be different characters. Maybe the same players, but different characters.
Different characters. Okay. And I guess my last general question is, have there been any mechanics that deal better with the fact that seemingly the average age of someone playing a Titter Pig has kind of extended? That, I mean, I run a Mage Chronicle, and I can reliably get my players together once a month. So in a year, we will have 60 hours, maybe, of role-playing, where it seems like sometimes games were designed with the assumption that every Tuesday we get together for 3 hours at the Android's Dungeon or something like that, and we play the darn game. Have any games come up with good mechanics for dealing with, oh, this player missed this session, or something like that, or dealing with more, I guess, intermittent play styles?
I think we're gradually moving away from the idea of a game that must be played as a long-term campaign. Look at Blades.
Oh, yeah, like, the score-based system.
So there's... you've got the score-based system, and you've got the little like flow chart for leveling up your crew. So while all the scores may be related as part of an overall plot, we could totally play this weekend, play a score, play for 2 to 4 hours or whatever. And then if I can't come next weekend, we just play a different score. Whoever else is there does another part of the plot. And it doesn't really matter that I'm not there, except for the fact that like maybe you should avoid violence because the cutter isn't there.
So it sounds like the flip side of that is this now requires the ability of a storyteller to kind of end sessions at a convenient point where if we think there's a good chance that someone's going to be missing, that we can kind of progress the plot, come up with a narrative reason why that character's not participating for a particular period of time, and then carry on. It seems like it's a string of pearls, as it were, as opposed to a tapestry being woven together. Is that something that can be said, that there are ways of dealing with the fact that not everyone's going to be able to make every session, but part of that depends either on the game or the ability of a storyteller to kind of modularize the plot?
Yeah, in something with a little bit older approach, like Old Mage, then that's story rad storyteller skill there. With something like Blades, you just have to think of the scores as discrete and then do your best to like make sure that they wrap up in the course of a session. Like, don't set up a score that can't be solved in one game. We play our Blades in the Dark game either once a month, like on a Friday night when we have basically all evening, but one of our players is in an improv group and frequently performs on Fridays. So we've switched back to alternating some Wednesdays once a month with our regular weekly game. And so we get a score done in a 2-hour playtime. And I mean, some of it also involves like your players being focused and willing to commit to playing. Like, obviously, if you know you have 2 hours of playtime, don't sit there with your thumb up your butt watching funny YouTube videos for an hour and a half. Yeah, when we meet up for our weekly night game, which is we play from 7 to 9, but we actually play from 7:30 to 9.
Oh, yeah, that.
Yeah, because we show up, we kibitz. It's some people I haven't seen. I mean, I see them on game night, but like, I don't see them all the time. And, mm-hmm. you know, we crack open a beer and make pizza together and have a meal, and then we play. And occasionally it runs long, but it usually doesn't run later than 10. But like, if anyone were to not show up, we would just run a different score. Like, if our slide weren't to be there, then we wouldn't play a social score. If I were to not be there, the whole party would die.
Yeah. The thing that had me particularly curious is Invisible Sun as a game looks endlessly fascinating, but at the same time, it looks so effing pretentious.
I feel the same way.
I just want to buy the books for the art purposes, because like the note. So Invisible Sun is a Monty Cook game. I loved Monty Cook because he did Planescape, and that was lovely. It had the greatest thing in a D&D campaign ever. The fact that your characters could never be the most powerful thing ever. There was always literally a god that could like smoke them bitches. And it's supposedly a surrealist game, which is fascinating to me, or has heavy elements of surrealism, because it pits a storyteller's desire to have this fantastical story weave, but it can be punishing to players to try and figure out rules when the world is such a moving target. And a lot of the stuff promoting the game is like, are you a true RPG fan? Do you look at other RPG fans and say, they're not actually RPG fans, they're not moody enough? Like, it was this weird, like, scene girl version of RPG promotions. But also, it theoretically had mechanics baked into it to help deal with when Jim can't make it over. So we've rattled off a bunch of games. Are there any that you haven't mentioned that if you're just like, hey, if you're interested in interesting mechanics and a well-built world, maybe you might want to look at this?
If you listen to Bonus Experience, you know I really like Through the Breach, but you also know that I have house ruled it into submission.
Yeah. call her the Widowmaker. Yeah.
I am a big fan of the card system in that. I'm not a big fan of its 61 skill long skill list. No, fuck
that's
that.
A lot of skills.
Too many skills. But like the the card system, the fact that the GM does not actually do any flipping is very reminiscent of flipping as in instead of rolling, is very reminiscent of like Apocalypse World and the Powered by the Apocalypse games where the GM doesn't touch the dice. Everything is based on a static TN. So like sneaking past an enemy doesn't involve the enemy flipping anything. It's you flipping your stealth and trying to beat the enemy's basically like passive perception.
Okay.
And it was a pretty easy system to sort of sneak partial successes into because the array of the way the numbers break down really easily into 1 to 5, 6 to 10, 11 to 13, the numbers on the cards. And then so you have weak, moderate, severe, and then you can just sort of like look at the outcome and then decide how fucked something is, whether it is weak, moderate, severe based on the card flipped. And I really love that setting a lot.
Yeah. Are there any projects you're working with or Onyx Path that you would like to share or promote?
That I can share and promote?
Done.
Yeah. Well, I am currently developing Titanomachy for Scion 2nd Edition, which is a pure antagonist book. It is about who the Scion's enemies are. It will come with a rogues gallery of the enemies of the gods for each of the core pantheons. It will come with three like mini adventure hooks. It will also come with how to use this stuff and how to approach running the idea of the Titans coming back in a pretty robust storytelling section. And then the rest of the book is brand new powers for optional Titan stuff and
Titan stuff.
Optional Titan stuff. I can't go into too much more detail.
Understood.
And then just a jam-packed section full of antagonists, which will include unique characters and monsters from basically any myth you could possibly think of.
And is that something that we're going to see on, is that just going to flop out to DriveThruRPG? Is there going to be a Kickstarter for that? Or
it is a supplement. It is not a major supplement, so I believe it is just going to flop out onto DriveThru. It is chugging along in first drafts. I cannot give you any dates. That is one of the things I am not allowed to tell you.
Understood.
I'm not allowed to give specific content, but I can sort of give you an overview of what you can expect and get hyped for.
Hype!
yeah, watch SGQ.
Yes! Yeah. Yes! They're like, we figured out a type of spung hacking that allows us to shave 2/10,000ths of a second off of this run if you do the entire thing only using your left mouse button. It took me 4,218 hours to train for it, but I knocked 9 frames off the world record.
Spectacular speedrunner impression. I'm also developing with Neil Vincent Price Exalted Storyteller's Guide, which is called Crucible of Legend, which will go over how to run Exalted, which the core book doesn't do. It'll be how to run Exalted. It'll touch on all the Exalt types that are out so far, some of them that are not. It's going to introduce some new stuff that I can't tell you about yet, and it will include some bits and bobs for how to adjust the rule system to, you know, how to approach it if you are house ruling, like we just had a big long conversation about, and some other like dials for making an otherwise mechanically dense system a little bit more manageable. And I'm writing that part. Yeah, you can look forward to that. That is also chugging along. Again, cannot give dates or specifics, but that's sort of what you can expect. Exalted STG hype.
Yeah, and if and if people are interested in listening to more of you having well-informed but strong opinions about games and gamecraft, where can we find more information about the bonus experience?
If you would like to hear more of two queer women speaking with authority about games, you can check out my show Bonus Experience at bxpcast.com. You can also look up Bonus Experience Podcast. That's on Podbean. It's on Google Podcasts. It's on Apple Podcasts. But we're part of the Misdirected Mark Network. You can also find us on misdirectedmark.com. And you can follow the show at bxpcast on Twitter.
Monica, thank you so much for joining. This was an utter delight.
You are welcome. Hopefully you can have us on again and you can talk to Ray too.
Oh, that would be super duper. Thank you for listening to Mage the Podcast. Follow us on Twitter at Mage the Podcast or visit our webpage, magethepodcast.com. If this is your first episode or otherwise haven't subscribed, please do. We're on all major pod platforms. We're available on Spotify, on anchor.fm, as well as directly through our webpage. If you have strong feelings about anything that was said, that's great. Give us an email at magethepodcast@gmail.com, and your Mage the Ascension non sequitur quote of the episode is, "Master, you see the bizarre everywhere. If you know what book that's from, you're a dork, and we love you for it. Terry out."